Yeah, actually, I'm going to tell you about a number of recent results coming out of Perimeter in the last year or so, and it's going to culminate in discussion of the stabilizer subtheory and how it has a unique non-contextual model. This result in the title was done with my collaborators Haoxing, John, and Matt, and some of the prior results that I'll discuss were also done with Ravi, Ellie, and Rob in various combinations. So I'm going to be talking a lot about non-classicality and which elements of the world kind of challenge our classical worldview. And the question is why? Why should we be interested in these questions? Well, if you're in this seminar, you probably agree that there's some intrinsic foundational interest to understanding non-classicality. Beyond that, non-classical phenomena are often used to power new technology, and especially with the quantum information revolution, power quantum information processing tasks. And furthermore, understanding the dividing line between the classical world and the quantum world guides us in our interpretation of quantum theory, which in turn guides us in extending quantum theory to new domains, whether these be like quantum gravity or artificial intelligence or quantum causality or so on. So in this talk, I'm going to take a particular angle towards studying classicality. I'm going to say that some theory or scenario is classical if it can be explained in a generalized non-contextual way. And I'll define generalized non-contextuality for you later in the talk. Roughly speaking, it's a principle which says that if you have some processes in the world that are indistinguishable no matter how you probe them, then your representation of them fundamentally should be equivalent. And so why am I claiming that this particular principle is a good notion of classicality? Well, there's kind of a growing list of reasons why, and I'm not going to focus on this too much, but it can be shown that this notion of the existence of a generalized non-contextual model is equivalent to a notion of classicality that's used in the quantum optics community. And it's also equivalent to a notion of classicality that's used in the framework of generalized probabilistic theories. It also emerges in the classical limit considered by the quantum Darwinist program. It's motivated by some principles for theory construction, like Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which has kind of a long history of being useful in physics, starting, well, not starting with, but exemplified by some of Einstein's best work. Furthermore, the failure of this notion of classicality subsumes a number of other notions of non-classicality, like Kochan-Specker contextuality, Bell non-locality, and the appearance of anomalous weak values. All of these can be shown to be instances of non-classicality of this sort. And furthermore, non-classicality of this sort is a resource for quantum computation, quantum communication, state discrimination, cloning, metrology. Like I said, non-classical phenomena power some of our new technologies and protocols. And I'm going to come back to these first two points and this third point. These are results that will be covered in this talk. So if you wanted to hear more, at least you'll hear more about some of these. So what are the results I'll cover in this talk? I'm going to start by defining a number of types of representations of operational theories and of generalized probabilistic theories, or GPTs. And then I'm going to talk about the relationships between these different representations, and in particular, show that they have a very simple mathematical structure under some mild assumptions. And then using that result about the mathematical structure of any such representation, I'm going to show that for any stabilizer subtheory in odd dimensions, there's a unique non-contextual model. There's only one way to understand it as some kind of classical world. And that model is given by Gross's discrete Wigner function, or equivalently by the Sphekins toy model. And we'll also show that for every stabilizer subtheory in even dimensions, you can find proofs of contextuality. So there's no non-contextual model. And as a consequence of this, we'll show that generalized contextuality is a necessary resource for quantum computation in a particular model for quantum computation. And it's worth noting that there's kind of related results that have already been known. So it was already known that Gross's Wigner function or Sphekins toy model provide a non-contextual model in odd dimensions for the stabilizer subtheory. What the key here is we're showing that this is the only non-contextual model. It's also known that the qubit stabilizer subtheory for dimension two is contextual, but we're extending that to all even dimensions. And it has previously been shown that Koch and Specker contextuality is a necessary resource for quantum computation. Here we're proving the analogous result for generalized contextuality. So Gross's discrete Wigner representation, it's a particular representation of the stabilizer subtheory on a classical phase space, and it's been very useful in studying quantum computation. So I'll just list a number of well-known results from this sphere. So Gottesman and Nill proved a theorem showing that the stabilizer subtheory can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer. And it's been shown that you can furthermore extend that simulation to include a strict superset of the stabilizer subtheory, including all processes that are represented non-negatively in Gross's representation. So positivity in this representation is important for simulability here. It's also been shown that every state that's useful for magic state distillation protocols has to be negative in Gross's representation. And furthermore, that every state that promotes the stabilizer subtheory to universal quantum computation using magic state distillation has to have Koch and Specker contextuality. So this builds on the previous result. And negativity in Gross's representation is a necessary resource for computation in some particular model for quantum computation. So there's all these interesting results that have been proven between relating negativity in this particular discrete Wigner representation and quantum computation and contextuality. And most of these results were proven by people at IQC, like Joe Emerson, Joel Wallman, Victor Veitch, and their group. Now, these are—
Sorry, David.
Yeah.
Could you go back to that list? What's the difference between the first and the last thing?
Well, so this first thing, the first point is referring to efficient simulations of the stabilizer subtheory and some, I think the last thing is proven using the first thing. So okay. It's not immediately clear to me that these are equivalent, but yeah, there's close relationships between all of these. This third thing is also proven on the back of the second thing and so on.
Yeah. Thanks.
So foundationally, these results pose a kind of interesting puzzle. In particular, it seems like there's this one particular quasi-probability representation, Gross's, that is playing a really important role in establishing a really strong form of non-classicality, that is the ability to do quantum computation. And that's a bit odd because normally it's not sufficient to say, oh, I've got a particular representation wherein my processes are represented negatively, therefore I have evidence for non-classicality. You really need to show that all possible quasi-probability representations go negative. Because if you found negativity in one representation, someone else might come along, find a second representation that's completely positive, gives you a simple classical model for what's going on, and then you could you wouldn't expect this to be powering any sort of quantum computation. And so there's this puzzle. Why is one specific quasi-probability representation being linked so strongly to a strong form of non-classicality? And we're going to give an answer to that question in this talk. The answer is because in the context of the stabilizer subtheory, this is the unique non-contextual representation. So generically, you can't just look for negativity in one representation, but using this result in the context of the stabilizer subtheory, it follows that negativity of a process does imply non-classicality in the sense of non-contextuality. And then that form of non-classicality is useful for things like universal quantum computation. And a nice little schematic for kind of organizing your thoughts is we have known links between quantum computation and negativity in Gross's representation. That's relating to that list I gave a few slides ago. What we're going to prove in this talk is that negativity in Gross's representation is linked to generalized contextuality, so non-classicality. And then just by transitivity here, our result furthermore provides a link between generalized contextuality and quantum computation. So that's where we're going. And I want to note that this is in perfect analogy with the results shown by Howard et al. In Nature 2014, where they prove a connection between gross negativity and Koch and Specker contextuality. And consequently, they prove that contextuality supplies the magic for quantum computation. So they establish a link like this by establishing a link like this through Gross's representation. So our result does for generalized contextuality what their result does for Koch and Specker contextuality. Okay, so before I get to all these results about computation and stabilizers, we're going to need a bunch of preliminaries. This is going to take about half the talk. But even if you've heard these preliminaries before, which many or most of you probably have, I think there will still be a number of new results in here that we've only come out with in the last year or so, and kind of a better mathematical framework for talking about the kinds of representations we're interested in. So hopefully you won't zone out, even if you've heard the words ontological model and operational theory more times than you'd like. So we're going to start with the framework of process theories. So a process theory can be thought of very simply as a collection of systems and a collection of processes on those systems, which is closed under composition. And a diagram preserving map from one process theory to another process theory is something that acts as follows. So we have some process F in our original process theory G, and under the action of the map, it's taken to its representation, eta of F. And of course, this thing now acts on systems in the second process theory. So these systems are a function eta of T and eta of S, a function of the systems of the original process. And I'm going to introduce a graphical notation for the application of this eta map to a process F like this. I'm going to draw a shaded box on top of the process that the map is being applied to and label that shaded box by the map. And the reason that I introduce this graphical notation is because these maps have a particular property that diagrams are preserved. It's right there in the name. What does that property mean? Well, let me kind of define it by example here. It means that if you have some circuit, a composition of various processes, maybe H, F, and G, and you apply the map to that circuit, then if it's diagram preserving, you can equivalently just apply the map to each individual component of the circuit and then wire those together, wire the representations in the new process theory together in exactly the same sense. And if this equality holds for every circuit, then you have a diagram preserving map. And you can see that this green, this shaded box notation is inherently a diagram preserving notation, because if I just kind of stitch these green edges together, then these two are manifestly equal. Okay, so what does quantum theory look like as a process theory? Well, I have to tell you what are the systems and what are the processes. So systems are vector spaces of Hermitian operators on a Hilbert space.
Sorry, and could I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
From the previous slide, just to make sure I understood.
Yeah.
So your map doesn't have to specify the input and output systems or something. I'm a little bit confused about dividing up these maps into the smaller elements, because your map on the left takes one system to two systems.
Right. So
the map, for example, on the you're using the same map. You put a green box around a system that just takes one to one, for example, on the right. So
right. Right, so the map is defined for all processes in the theory. Any process in the first process theory gets mapped to some process in the second theory. And so here you can think of it like, on the left, we're taking a circuit with one input and two outputs to a circuit with one input and two outputs, but where we can decompose the action of the map into its action on each constituent element. So here we have a process with two outputs. And if we apply the map just to a process with two outputs, then we get a process with two outputs. So it might have helped if I'd labeled these wires here. At this point, these black wires are representing systems in the original process theory. And then once you've applied this map to it, so once you have these systems here, now these are systems in the new process theory. And we're wiring it together with an identity process and the with the representation of the identity process and the representation of the F process, and then wiring those together with the representation of the G process. And altogether, we're left again with a process on one system to two systems in the representation. Does that help?
Okay, yeah. So it's really a family of maps that you can apply to any system, this eta object.
I guess you could think of it as a family of maps if you're thinking of like that family indexed by the different kinds of systems or process types. But if you want to just think of it as a map on a process theory, then you could also just think of it as a single.
Okay, you think of it like a map on the whole theory itself.
So that's right.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So what is quantum theory as a process theory? Well, the systems are vector spaces of Hermitian operators on a Hilbert space. And the processes are just channels acting on these spaces. So in particular, if you have a process with no inputs, that's a state in the theory, namely a density operator. And a process with no output is an effect. So as a very simple example, if you have a kind of prepare transform measure scenario, here's that process with no inputs, it's a quantum state rho. A process with an input and an output is a channel. A process with no output is an effect in quantum theory. And the composition in this process theory is just given by the Born rule. So the composition of these three processes is given by the trace of the effect with the channel acting on the quantum state. So it's really just kind of a graphical notation for the things we're all familiar with. A second process theory that's going to be really important for us is the process theory of substochastic maps. So you can think of the systems here as sets, and the processes are substochastic maps from one set to another. So they're stochastic maps, which can be subnormalized to allow us to represent things like post-selection. And an example here would be Liouvillean mechanics. So you've got some classical phase space and some probability distributions over that space, which are evolving under some stochastic maps. And maybe, again, if you allow post-selection, maybe evolving under some substochastic maps. Processes with no inputs are just subnormalized probability distributions. Processes with no outputs are response functions or things that map these subnormalized distributions to valid probabilities. And so again, if we have this kind of prepare, transform, measure type scenario, we are mapping some subnormalized probability distribution under some substochastic map and then mapping it into a probability. And composition here is just given by matrix multiplication like this. So this looks a lot just like a standard classical probability theory. And a third process theory we're going to introduce is the same as the one I just introduced, except now it's quasi-substochastic, which is to say the probabilities in these, the real numbers in these matrices can now go negative. So you can't interpret this any longer as kind of classical probability theory updating because probabilities don't go negative. But again, we have the systems are sets, processes are just a particular type of matrices. And we have negativity appearing. So these are the three process theories that we're going to use in this talk. And the intuition for why I'm introducing these three process theories, we're going to start with some quantum scenario. We're going to apply the representation map, which is going to be a map from the quantum process theory into either the substochastic process theory or the quasi-substochastic process theory. We're going to use diagram preservation of that map. So to represent the individual components of this quantum circuit in as individual components in the representation wired together. And so we're left with these stochastic processes composed in a way that mirrors the quantum processes. So that's what a sort of representation of quantum theory is going to look like. And we're going to be interested in classical representations into these kind of like Liouvillean mechanics, if you like. So what are the kinds of things we're going to want to represent? Well, we're going to want to represent quantum theory, of course. But we can speak a bit more broadly and talk about operational theories, including quantum theory, but also including hypothetical other theories. So what's an operational theory? Well, it's a process theory, of course. Everything we're doing is going to be a process theory, so it's all nice and compositional. So it has some systems, which you can think of as the physical degrees of freedom in your problem. And the processes are laboratory procedures applied to these systems. So this is a kind of abstract, not a very structured notion of a process. You can think of it as just a list of instructions for what kind of devices you should build in your lab and how you should apply them to your physical degrees of freedom. And it's a process theory endowed with a probability rule, by which I mean anytime you draw a closed diagram, there will be some associated probability. So here we'd have the probability of this effect occurring, outcome E occurring, given that we've prepared state S. And because this is a process theory, we can build up these arbitrarily complicated circuits, and any closed diagram is going to have an associated probability to it. The main notion we're going to need within an operational theory is what it means for two procedures to be operationally equivalent. So we say that a procedure T is operationally equivalent to a second procedure T prime if and only if these two procedures give rise to all the same probabilistic predictions, no matter what circuit you embed them in. So here I have represented a generic embedding of T, an embedding of T into a generic circuit. It can always be represented in this form as some big state with a side channel and some big effect. And if I put T and T prime in the same circuit, then if this equality holds for all possible effects and states, then it holds for all possible circuits, and we say that they're operationally equivalent procedures. Once we have this definition of what it means for two procedures to be operationally equivalent, we can look at them all sort of pairwise and group them together into equivalence classes. So here we have maybe these three procedures are operationally equivalent, these two are operationally equivalent, and so on. And we can introduce a useful notation now where each procedure is labeled by two values. It's labeled by its equivalence class, so which one of these equivalence classes is the procedure in? And second of all, which element within that class is it? And I'll call that the context variable. It's the information which isn't relevant to how that procedure leads you to make probabilistic predictions, but it is relevant for just specifying the identity of the procedure. So looking at this picture here, we can come up with a labeling of all of our procedures by their equivalence class and their context. And it might help to see an example of an operational equivalence if you're not familiar with this sort of thing. So for states, processes with no inputs, two states are operationally equivalent if they give the same probabilities for all possible effects. So here the probability of E given S is equal to the probability of E given S prime for all possible effects in the theory. That's what it means for two states to be operationally equivalent. And within quantum theory, we have lots of examples of this coming from the fact that different convex mixtures of states can give rise to the same density operator. So in particular, if I go to the laboratory and I prepare an equal, with equal probability, I either prepare the state zero or the pure state one, well, that mixture is just equal to the maximally mixed state. And if I alternatively prepare an equal mixture of the pure states plus and minus, that mixture is also equal to the maximally mixed state. So there's no measurement you can do to tell these two mixtures apart. And so these are two completely different things you can do in the laboratory, which are operationally equivalent. Two procedures which are operationally equivalent. And you can think of the equivalence class of mixtures of quantum states like this as just being labeled by the density operator corresponding to that mixed ensemble preparation. Once we have this idea of operational equivalence, we can quotient an operational theory with respect to it. And this was kind of first done by the Pavia group and their framework for operational probabilistic theories. So what does it mean to quotient an operational theory? Well, remember this picture we had. We have these equivalence classes of procedures. Quotienting, basically, you can think of it as picking a single representative element for each equivalence class, and then defining the theory of those representative elements. So a bit more formally, the reason we introduced this notation earlier is that now we can define the quotienting map, which I'll denote by this tilde, as something which takes processes in the original operational theory, so they're labeled by the equivalence class in the context, and it just throws away the context information. So you're keeping the equivalence class information and only the equivalence class information. You're only keeping that information which is relevant to making operational predictions. So that's how the quotienting map acts. Diagrammatically, if we have some process here with some input and output in the operational theory, and we apply the quotienting map to it, it just gets rid of the context information. So this process on the right here is living in the quotiented operational theory. And you can see that because there's no context labeling it. And if you're familiar with the framework of generalized probabilistic theories, or GPTs, the quotiented theory is just the GPT which is associated with the operational theory. If you're not familiar with GPTs, then don't worry about it. Just take this as the definition of a GPT. It's the theory you get after you quotient an operational theory. And just to give you a little bit of intuition for these, the standard way people think about GPTs, the state space of a GPT is specified by a convex set. So here, every point in this convex set corresponds to a vector in this vector space. And every point in this convex set corresponds to a vector in the effect space. And if you take the inner product of a vector representing a state with a vector representing an effect, then you get the probability of an effect given that state. So the probabilistic content of the theory, namely the observable statistics, are given by the geometry. So as we vary over the different geometries of state and effect spaces, we're varying over possible ways the world could be. So quantum theory will be associated with a particular state space geometry and a particular effect space geometry. You can think of the block ball, for example. For a two-dimensional quantum system, the block ball is the state space, and there's a corresponding effect space, and so on. But as we vary these geometries, we're varying over possible theories. And because these GPTs arose by quotienting operational theories, a state or an effect, two states or effects are distinct if and only if they give distinct probabilities. And of course, GPTs also allow for transformations, which are linear maps on the state space, or equivalently linear maps on the effect space. Okay, so those are the types of theories we're gonna consider: operational theories and quotiented operational theories, or GPTs. And of course, quantum theory will be our main example of these. And we're gonna talk now about representations of these kinds of operational theories, or GPTs. So the first kind of representation that we're gonna be interested in are ontological models of operational theories. So what is an ontological model? It's a diagram preserving map from the operational theory to the process theory of substochastic matrices. So here's our process in the operational theory. We're going to apply a representation map, and we're left with a process on some set corresponding to system A and some set corresponding to system B, where this process is just some substochastic matrix representing the process in the operational theory. And of course, this map has to be diagram preserving. It also has to satisfy two kind of obvious conditions. It has to reproduce the predictions of the original process theory, and it has to represent the discarding or ignoring operation appropriately. So what do I mean by these? Well, I'll tell you what I mean by reproducing the predictions. If you have some quantum circuit, here's a simple example. If you have a quantum circuit like this and you represent it in the substochastic theory, so you apply the representation map, as we saw earlier, by diagram preservation, we can just talk about the representation of each element of the circuit individually. And the representation of the state will be some subnormalized probability distribution, or if the state is normalized, it'll be a normalized probability distribution, some stochastic map, and some response function. In particular, we said this quantum composition is given by the Born rule, and this substochastic matrix composition is given by matrix multiplication. So if the representation is to reproduce the quantum predictions, it better be that these two are equal. And these diagrams here are just stating exactly what's stated down here in the more familiar language. So that's an ontological model of an operational theory. What about an ontological model of a GPT? So this looks very similar. Again, it's a diagram preserving map, but the domain of the map is now not operational, not an operational theory, but a quotiented operational theory or a GPT. So it's a slightly different kind of map because the domain is different. In particular, the processes we're talking about representing here are living in a GPT, so there's no context variable. But again, we just apply the map to map it to map a given process into its representation as a substochastic map. And again, we need to demand that in this new theory, composing things reproduces the predictions of those same things in the operational theory. And the key difference here compared to ontological models of operational theories is that because there's no context information here labeling this system, the representation, labeling this process, the representation of this process also can't depend on the context. And that's going to be important later. So the final kind of representation that we're going to talk about is not an ontological model of a GPT, but a quasi-probability representation of a GPT. And so the only difference here is that instead of mapping things into the process theory of substochastic matrices, we're going to map them into the process theory of quasi-substochastic matrices. In other words, the representation now can have negativity in it. That's the only change. And clearly, if you have a representation like this that happens to be positive for every process in the original theory, the representation happens to be positive, then we'll call that a positive quasi-probability representation. And by definition, it's just also an ontological model, because we said the only difference between a quasi-probability representation and an ontological model of a GPT is whether these real values in these matrices go negative or not. So a positive quasi-probability representation of a GPT is just an ontological model. Okay, so those are the basic preliminaries. Now we can finally talk about what it means for a given theory or scenario to be classical. When does it have a classical explanation? Well, for operational theories, I argued on a slide earlier that what it means for an operational theory to be classically explainable is for there to exist a non-contextual representation of it. So I can finally define that for you a little more carefully. An ontological model of an operational theory is non-contextual if and only if it satisfies the following constraint. So when you have two operationally equivalent procedures in the operational theory, they have to be represented by the same stochastic map. So here we see the stochastic map representing T, the stochastic map representing T prime, and those two have to be equal. Or to put it another way, if these two procedures differ only by their context, C and C prime, but they have the same equivalence class, then they have to get mapped to the same stochastic map. So this representation of each of them does not depend on the context variable. So that's what it means for an operational theory to be classical. What about for GPTs? Well, the problem is that you can't directly apply the notion of non-contextuality to a representation of a GPT. And the reason is, as we said earlier, there's no context left in your GPT. So you can't ask, does the representation of a process depend on context or not, if there aren't any contexts around to even be asked about. So just to put them on the same slide, here's what an ontological model of an operational theory looks like. We've got our generic procedure, and its representation can depend on both the equivalence class and the context of that procedure. But in an ontological model of a GPT, there's no context here that we can ask, you know, does this representation depend on the context? Well, it's not a well-defined question. However, what we show in this paper here is we can nonetheless derive some consequences of non-contextuality for the framework of generalized probability theories and derive a notion of classicality using this. So how's this going to work? Well, consider an operational theory, op, and the GPT G defined by quotienting it. Then in this paper, we prove a theorem, which is there exists a non-contextual ontological model of the operational theory if and only if there exists an ontological model of the GPT. So we're not talking about non-contextuality of the representation of the GPT. We're just talking about the existence of any ontological model. And we prove this connection. And this connection is not too hard to prove, really. If you think of the relationship between these different objects, we have an operational theory. To get a GPT out of it, we quotient. We apply this quotienting map. So if there exists an ontological model of the GPT, well, that's a map from the GPT into some substochastic ontological model. And if we now just define a non-contextual representation of the operational theory as the composition of first quotienting and then this ontological model of the GPT, well, that definition of this map will clearly be a non-contextual representation, because the first thing you do when you quotient is you throw away the context, and then this representation here won't have any context to depend on. So that's some intuition for one direction of this theorem, and the other direction is a little more complicated, but not so bad. So the upshot of all this is, if you buy all these motivations that we have for saying that an operational theory is classical, if there exists a non-contextual ontological model for it, then as a result, you get a notion of classicality for GPTs, and your notion should be the existence of an ontological model for your GPT. So now we've kind of indirectly derived from non-contextuality, a notion of classicality for GPTs, namely the existence of an ontological model for the GPT. And it's worth noting there's two equivalent ways of thinking about this. The first one's super obvious. It's just an ontological model is the same as a positive quasi-probability representation. So equivalently, you could say a GPT is classical if there exists a positive quasi-probability representation of it. And another equivalent condition is if there exists a simplex embedding. And I'm going to have to define that for you. This is also a result of this paper. In building up to this definition, I'll say a few words about the traditional notion of classicality in GPTs. So traditionally, a GPT has been considered classical if it's simplicial. That is, if the state space is a simplex and the effect space is the dual of a simplex. So if you have these geometries of a simplex and its dual, then people say that these GPTs are classical. Here's an example for dimension 3. Oops, sorry. And the point is, the reason people say these are classical is because in a simplicial GPT, all possible measurements are compatible. Just like in a, you know, Newtonian mechanics or something, you can do a single measurement that teaches you the exact state of the system. Similarly for these simplicial GPTs. Now, if I just label the vertices of these state and effect spaces of the simplex and the dual in a suggestive way, so here, note that all of these vertices are corresponding to valid subnormalized probability distributions. And furthermore, then, every point in the convex hull of these four points is also corresponding to a valid subnormalized probability distribution. Similarly, the points in the convex hull of these eight points, which are dual to this state space, every point in this convex hull is a valid response function, by which I mean the inner product of all these points with any of these points is a valid number between 0 and 1. So it should be fairly intuitive then that if I have a GPT which can be fit inside this state space and this effect space, then I can just think of the points in the space as some representation of that original GPT. And it's a valid ontological model for that GPT. So that's a very kind of brief intuitive description of how we get to the result in this paper. The result is a GPT admits of an ontological model if and only if it can be embedded inside a simplex and the dual to that simplex. In other words, a simplicial GPT of some dimension. The tricky thing here that you have to remember is the embedding might be for higher dimensional simplices. So if someone comes to you and gives you a state space of a particular dimension, you have to check higher dimensional simplex embeddings as well. So at this point, we have four equivalent ways of thinking about when a GPT, or a quotiented operational theory, is classically explainable. If the operational theory it came from is non-contextual, then it's classical. Equivalently, if it admits of an ontological model. Equivalently, if it embeds inside a simplex and the dual to the simplex. Equivalently, if it admits of a positive quasi-probability representation. And the reason it's nice to have these equivalent conditions, well, first of all, these equivalences give us new reasons to think that non-contextuality is a good notion of classicality. In particular, this idea of positive quasi-probability representations being a classical representation that's got a long history in the quantum optics community. And this notion of simplex embeddability, I very briefly showed you earlier how it can be motivated from the traditional notion of classicality in the GPT community. So these are kind of those two new motivations for taking non-contextuality as classicality that I said at the start of the talk. And another reason why these equivalences are useful is that sometimes one of these is easier to study than the other, depending on your particular context. And the one that's usually, I think, the easiest to study is this notion of positive quasi-probability representations. And so the next result I'm going to tell you about is a mathematical result about the structure of these quasi-probability representations. So remember, I said a quasi-probability representation of a GPT, you can think of it as an ontological model whose probabilities can go negative. These things don't have probabilities don't have any real interpretation if they go negative. Real numbers that go negative don't really make sense to think of as probabilities. So this is, you know, a very loose heuristic. Quasi-probability representations have usually only been defined in the past for quantum theory, and we're going to define them for arbitrary GPTs. And there's not really any kind of single established definition of a quasi-probability representation. I've given one in this talk, that's the definition I'm going to be using, but it's worth noting that not all things that have been called quasi-probability representations have conformed to our definition. The most famous ones do conform to our definition, which is, you know, one of the main motivations why we think it's a reasonable term to use for the type of representation we've introduced. So for example, the Wigner representation and Gross's discrete representation and all of the representations studied by Gibbons, Hoffman, and Wouters, all of these conform to our definition. But some representations like the Q and P representations in quantum optics are not diagram preserving, for example. Okay, but we're just going to stick with the definition that I've given so far. And we prove in this paper here a structure theorem. So we prove that all diagram preserving quasi-probability representations of arbitrary GPTs, but I'm going to focus here on quantum theory to make everything look familiar, have a particular structure. So in other words, they can be defined as follows. First, you pick a basis of trace one Hermitian operators corresponding to your the space of Hermitian operators on the Hilbert space of interest. Then you can compute a unique dual basis, so some set of Hermitian operators d lambda prime satisfying this orthonormality condition. And then you represent your states, your quantum states, by tracing, you represent them as a real vector, a vector of real numbers, given by the trace of the quantum state with elements of this dual basis. You represent your effects by tracing your effects with elements of the original basis. And you represent your transformations by acting those transformations on elements of the original basis and tracing with the dual basis elements. So this is how you compute those substochastic representations of your quantum processes. And every single diagram preserving quasi-probability representation can be constructed in exactly this form, with the caveat that we're here assuming some technical assumption of tomographic completeness, which quantum theory does satisfy, and we're considering scenarios with transformations. So we don't yet know whether or not there's an analogous result in the kind of thin air of prepare measure scenarios. Okay, so I presented this for quantum theory. If you have some arbitrary GPT, it looks very much the same, but now this is a basis for the GPT state space. So every ontological model of a tomographically local GPT has a form like the one on the previous slide, but where everything in the image of this map is positive. Sorry, that transition was bad. The point is here we have a structure theorem for quasi-probability representations. Because an ontological model is just a positive quasi-probability representation, we also now have a structure theorem for ontological models of GPTs. So if you have something of this form where it turns out that all of these vectors of real numbers, or matrices of real numbers are positive, then you get an ontological model of a GPT, and every such ontological model has this structure. Similarly, because of the equivalence between a non-contextual ontological model of an operational theory and an ontological model of the GPT, this is also a structure theorem for non-contextual models. So in other words, you can think of it as we have now three different structure theorems for the three kinds of representations that we've been interested in. And one final comment is, because we start this construction by choosing a basis for the GPT state space, it follows that the number of ontic states in this representation, or the number of elements in the kind of the set being used to define your stochastic processes, it's a very constrained number. It has to be exactly equal to the dimension of the GPT state space. And this is a very powerful tool now for studying non-contextuality, because this, first of all, the mathematical structure of these objects is so constrained, and furthermore, the number of ontic states is so constrained that it becomes easy to derive proofs of contextuality. So for example, Lucien Hardy's excess baggage theorem showed that for a qubit in some simple Prepair-Measure scenario, you need an arbitrarily large number of ontic states in some ontological model to represent the statistics appropriately. And because this arbitrarily large number of ontic states is greater than the dimension of a qubit, the GPT, the Hilbert space, the dimension of the Hermitian operators space, which is 4 for a qubit, it follows that you can come up with proofs of contextuality. Or another example, there's something called the 8-state model, which is an ontological model defined by Wallman and Bartlett for describing stabilizer qubits. And it's been shown to be contextual by Lily Stone et al. By considering some scenario with transformations. And it can be proven more easily using our structure theorem just by the fact that their model has 8 ontic states, which again is greater than the GPT dimension of a qubit, which is 4. So, I mean, this is kind of crazy if you think about it. It's saying that within our assumptions, any ontological model of a GPT or non-contextual model of an operational theory has to have just 4 ontic states. That's supposed to reproduce all the quantum predictions. And if you can't do that, then it's got to be a contextual model. So it's just a very powerful result in that sense. So finally, I can turn now and tell you about the stabilizer subtheory and our results for it. So what is the stabilizer subtheory? Well, it's a very important set. It's a process theory, which is composed of a strict subset of all the quantum states, effects, and transformations. And it's important for quantum error correction, information processing, computation, foundations. It's got a lot of uses. Practically, the reason we care about the stabilizer subtheory is that the processes in it can be implemented fault tolerantly. And if you do a fault-tolerant implementation of the stabilizer subtheory, and then you inject into it some particular non-stabilizer states, then you can construct an arbitrary quantum circuit. So you promote the stabilizer subtheory to universality. And this leads to one of the leading proposals for how to build a fault-tolerant quantum computer called the state injection model for quantum computation. Formally, the stabilizer subtheory on a single system of dimension D will be defined as follows. Here's the computational basis for some system of dimension D. I'll denote the dth root of unity by omega. And now I need to define for you the generalized Pauli operators. So a Pauli operator X in dimension D acts by taking the computational basis states to just increment them by 1. This is like, you can think of this as translating the position. And the generalization of the Pauli Z gate, it acts as follows. Each computational basis state picks up some phase proportional to its value in the computational basis. So you can think of this as like translating the momentum. And from these two, we can define an arbitrary Weyl operator as just the various product of some number Q of X's and some number P of Z operators. So this is an arbitrary Weyl operator. You can think of it as shifting the position by a value Q and shifting the momentum by a value P, where P and Q are elements of that they're integers mod D. And the states in the stabilizer subtheory are just eigenstates of Weyl operators. And the measurements in the stabilizer subtheory are projective measurements in the eigenbases of these Weyl operators. So that's how you define the states and effects in the stabilizer subtheory. What about transformations? The allowed transformations are what's known as Clifford unitaries. And these are the ones, they're defined as those that preserve the Weyl operators. By which I mean, if I take one of those Weyl operators I just defined, and I conjugate it by a unitary, if I get something that's proportional to one of the other Weyl operators, then this U is a valid Clifford unitary, which means it's allowed in the definition of this stabilizer subtheory. And that's pretty much all you need to define the stabilizer subtheory. Note that the way we've defined it, it's closed under composition. And we also allow arbitrary convex mixtures of the processes in the stabilizer subtheory. So we close it under convex mixing. That was all the definition of the stabilizer subtheory for a single system of dimension D. What if you have n systems of dimension D? Well, then you do things analogously, but you don't start with Weyl operators on a single system. You start with n-fold tensor products of the Weyl operators. And the key here is, an important thing to note here that Gross noted, is that the stabilizer subtheory on n qubits is not the same as one as the stabilizer subtheory on one d to the n dimensional system. So even though the dimensions of these two kinds of systems are the same, the multi-particle view and the single particle view lead you to different definitions of the stabilizer subtheory. And that's fine. They're just sort of independent stabilizer subtheories that you can study. So what is Gross's representation for the stabilizer subtheory? Well, it's pretty easy, given that I've already told you what the structure of every quasi-probability representation has to be. To tell you how his representation works, I just need to tell you what are the elements of the basis that he picked. And this is how he defined them. So each element of the basis is indexed by a P and a Q, which again are integers mod D. And they're defined as some particular linear combination of the Weyl operators. The details of it won't be important. This basis has come to be known as the phase space point operators. And the reason for that is because these operators are indexed by P and Q, which can be thought of as points in a phase space. So for Q-trits, there's three possible values of P, three possible values of Q. So we have a kind of discrete phase space. And equivalently, we have nine possible states of the world here. You know, the position of momentum can be 0, 0, or they can be 1, 1, et cetera. So what does the representation look like in Gross's representation? Well, like always, you take the trace of your given density operator with the elements of your basis indexed here by P and Q, and you end up with a set of nine probabilities for each quantum state. And here's what the 12 pure states in the Q-trit stabilizer subtheory look like. There's exactly three non-zero probabilities. So here we see what those look like. So the white squares are corresponding to probability zero and the blue ones to probability 1/3. So we see that we always have kind of uniform probabilities in some line on the phase space. And if you don't know anything, so that we have a maximally mixed state, which is represented as the uniform distribution over the whole phase space. And you can even compute the representation of multiple systems. So here's the representation of two Q-trits. And in particular, this is the representation of a highly entangled, a maximally entangled state. And you can see that it has some kind of correlations between the positions and momenta of the two particles. To give you some intuition for how the representation of transformations looks like in this theory, well, we just apply the rule that I wrote down earlier, where now the transformation is some Clifford unitary, some stabilizer unitary. We can represent that by its action on the points in the phase space, or alternatively by a substochastic map on the phase space here. And in fact, these maps, when these unitaries are taken to be stabilizer, they turn out to be permutations. And here's some permutation corresponding to an entangling unitary on some pair of particles. And I've kind of snuck something in here. We're talking about a quasi-probability representation. So in principle, these things could all go negative, but I've been talking about them as valid probability distributions and stochastic maps and so on. And I've done that because it turns out that Gross's representation is in fact positive, as long as all the processes you're talking about representing are within the stabilizer subtheory. So we know that Gross's representation then, because it's a positive ontological model for this stabilizer GPT, it follows that Gross's representation provides an ontological model for the stabilizer subtheory. So furthermore, now I'm finally getting to the main result of our paper here. Not only is it a positive quasi-probability representation, but we showed the following theorem. In odd dimensions, every stabilizer subtheory, meaning the single particle ones, the multi-particle ones, has a unique positive quasi-probability representation, namely Gross's representation, the one I just went through briefly. Equivalently, there's a unique non-contextual ontological model for the stabilizer subtheory viewed as an operational theory. And remember that Gross's representation is equivalent to Speckens' toy theory, so that gives you kind of another equivalent way of understanding this theorem. In even dimensions, we proved that there's no positive quasi-probability representation for any stabilizer subtheory. Equivalently, there's no non-contextual ontological model. So this is a kind of surprising result, I think, that we started with this principle of generalized non-contextuality, which, you know, it's defined fairly abstractly. It's motivated by some principles like Leibniz's principle. And it's not really clear when you first see the definition, like what's the scope of all possible non-contextual representations? You might think there's lots of weird and wacky representations and weird and wacky non-contextual models. And how could you possibly hope to study the set of all possible such representations? And we've seen that actually the structure of these guys is now understood to be fairly rigid. And within the context of the stabilizer subtheory, it's so rigid that it picks out an exact ontology. So if the world were described by the stabilizer subtheory, there would be a unique ontology picked out by this result. There'd be a unique way of understanding what was going on in as a kind of classical theory. So this kind of gives us some hope that maybe the principles underlying generalized non-contextuality can also be used to single out an ontology for all of quantum theory. But there's obviously a lot of caveats there in future work. So if anyone's interested in that, we can discuss it at the end, which is coming soon, don't worry. Okay, so practically, the upshot of this result is that in the setting of the odd dimensional stabilizer subtheory, whenever you have a process that's represented negatively, you know that that process, together with the stabilizer subtheory, has no non-contextual model. It's non-classical. And okay, very briefly, because I know I'm over time, I'll just say Gross previously had kind of given some plausibility argument for why his representation was special. He noted that his was the only representation among some family of representations that had been previously studied, which satisfied a property called Clifford covariance. And his representation was already known to be unique in some particular sense. And I want to say why our result is stronger than Gross's uniqueness result. Most importantly, generalized non-contextuality is a notion of classicality, whereas covariance is not a notion of classicality. So there's kind of a deep foundational significance to our uniqueness result, whereas Gross's result is more just like, look, my model has a very nice, elegant mathematical symmetry, this Clifford covariance. Furthermore, Gross's result requires two ad hoc mathematical assumptions, namely that the representation is on a D by D phase space and has some representation of the marginal probabilities appropriately. And the point here is that neither of these assumptions is provable empirically, nor is it kind of justified conceptually. They're just, again, nice mathematical properties for your representation to have. But in our result, we've proven that these follow from non-contextuality. So we don't need these assumptions. And finally, Gross's result about uniqueness holds only for odd prime dimensions, while our result holds for all odd dimensions. And as I mentioned in the motivational slides, this result explains the demonstrated usefulness of Gross's representation in studying quantum computation. So we had this picture earlier where we've shown that negativity in Gross's representation implies it implies the failure of non-contextuality, and that through transitivity here shows a link between generalized contextuality and quantum computation. So just to repeat what I said at the start of the talk, it's known, here's one of those known links between negativity and Gross's representation and universal quantum computation. Any state which promotes the stabilizer subtheory to universal quantum computation has to have negativity in its Gross's representation. And what Howard et al. Showed in their Nature paper was negativity in Gross's representation of a state implies Hilkens-Becker contextuality. What we showed is that negativity in Gross's representation of a state implies generalized contextuality. And so now putting either of these results together with this result up here, we get that generalized contextuality, or equivalent, or alternatively, Hilkens-Becker contextuality, are necessary resources for universal quantum computation in this model. That just follows by taking the composition of these two or the composition of these two. So again, we're doing something very analogous to what Howard et al. Did. And final slide of the talk. So we've seen that generalized contextuality is a necessary resource for computation in this model. Can it be viewed as a sufficient resource for quantum computation? Well, obviously not, unless we make some more assumptions at least. And the reason this is obvious is because it's well known that the two-dimensional stabilizer subtheory, and now we know even all even-dimensional stabilizer subtheories are contextual, and yet they're efficiently simulatable. That's the Gottesman-Knill theorem that I talked about earlier. So clearly we don't have sufficiency, but maybe if we study some kind of resource theory of contextuality, and then we could show that if you have enough contextuality, that would be a sufficient condition. But this is speculative. A final result that we prove in our paper that's related to this question of sufficiency, and it's just kind of cute, is that it's well known that every non-stabilizer pure state and unitary promote the stabilizer subtheory to universality. And it's also now known that every non-stabilizer pure state and unitary has a negative Gross representation. So Gross proved this for pure states, we proved this for unitaries, and maybe someone has previously proved it, but not that I'm aware of. So it follows by taking these two facts together that for pure states and unitaries, Gross's negativity in Gross's representation is a sufficient condition for promoting to universality. But the really interesting question here is for non-pure states and for arbitrary quantum channels, what can we say about sufficiency? So I don't know how important this result for this limited case is. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Sorry for going a bit over. The results I talked about here are primarily in these two papers. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Does anyone have a question? I probably shouldn't ask a question as a co-author, but this is something that's just occurred to me. Is there a sense in which if this result wasn't true, then somebody would have screwed up in defining the stabilizer formalism? Because if there were two different representations that represented the stabilizer formalism positively, then you could just pick one of them and enlarge the subtheory to include all the things that are positive in that. And then you'd have like a richer subtheory that's still classical. So yeah, I'm just wondering if there's a sense in which
it
would have been a problem if this was not true.
Well,
it's a shortcoming of the stabilizer subtheory.
Well, note that the set of processes represented positively by Gross's representation is actually a strict subset, a strict superset of the stabilizer subtheory. So there are non-stabilizer mixed states, at least, which are represented positively. So you could say, you know, let's stick those into the subtheory, and then, you know, you have a strictly larger classical thing. But I think you'd lose all the kind of elegant properties of the subtheory. So, I mean, granted, it might be an interesting question, what's the largest possible classically explainable subtheory of quantum theory? But you might get something ugly. It might not have the useful properties of the stabilizer subtheory for other purposes.
Okay, last chance for questions from anyone else. All right. Thanks a lot for the talk. Thanks everyone for coming.
Yeah, thanks everyone.